You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, November 28th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable lunch district of New York City. Today on the show, I've got a horrible cold. A terrible, wretched cold. As such, we're probably going to have a very abbreviated program, ladies and gentlemen. However, it will feature fresh new content. My recent interview with Thomas Frank, author of his latest Pity the Billionaire. Thomas Frank, of course, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? And the Wrecking Crew. He talks to us about those poor billionaires that occupy Wall Street. He's one of those people very excited to see what's happening with Occupy Wall Street. And it's a great interview. You will enjoy it. I was very sick yesterday. I came in this morning hoping that I would feel better at one point. I thought that once that on-air light flickered in front of me, I'm speaking, of course, metaphorically, we don't actually have an on-air light in this studio, that I would feel much better, and I'm sorry, I don't. I anticipate being better tomorrow. I've canceled my Monday appearance on Dylan Radigan's show. I'm looking forward to going home and sleeping. Some of the big stories that I would have talked about today a big story by Bloomberg News as a result of their Freedom of Information Act request of the Fed that went to court and Bloomberg won shows just how far the Fed went in bailing out these big banks, far beyond the $700 billion TARP, whose success we get trumpeted all the time. Looking at over $1 trillion worth of loans, and most importantly, that provided $13 billion worth of profit for the banks. And from that piece, the cost to taxpayers, they paid a price beyond dollars as the secret funding helped preserve a broken status quo and enabled the biggest banks to grow even bigger. In other words, our bailout did nothing but increase the chances of an even larger problem down the road. And simultaneously, we are seeing Europe, the European debt crisis, become even larger, and it's coming to a head. It's unclear as to whether or not the Eurozone is going to break up or reconfigure into something smaller or what. A great piece in... Forgive me, folks. I literally can barely read here. by Robert Skidelsky. He is a member of the British House of Lords, a professor emeritus at the Political Economy at Warwick University. He writes that in Europe, the recovery, goes the refrain, has been derailed by the Eurozone crisis. But this is to turn the matter on its head. The Eurozone crisis did not derail the recovery. It is a result of a lack of recovery. It is the natural, predictable, and by many predicted result of the main European country deliberate policy of repressing aggregate demand. In other words, this crisis in Europe is a function of a lack of recovery, and that lack of recovery is a direct result of an austerity program. He goes on to provide a basic economic course, or a basic economic literacy course. He says, unfortunately for all of us, is an explanation that bears repeating nowadays. Depressions, recessions, contractions, call them what you will, occur because the private sector spends less than it did previously. This means that its income falls because spending by one firm or household is income for another. In this situation, government deficits rise naturally as tax revenues decline and spending on unemployment insurance and other benefits rise. These automatic stabilizers plug part of the private sector spending gap. But if the government starts reducing its own deficit before private sector spending recovers, the net result will be further decline in total spending, and hence in total income, causing the government's deficit to widen rather than narrow. True, if governments stop spending altogether, deficits will eventually fall to zero. People will starve to death in the interim, but the budget will be balanced. That is the crazy logic of current economic policy in much of Europe and elsewhere. Of course, it will not be carried through to the bitter end. Too much will crack along the way. The banks, the monetary system, social cohesion, the legitimacy of the political regime. Deficit reduction eventually will be put into cold storage, either openly, as I would prefer, or surreptitiously, as politicians, as is the politician's way. In the United Kingdom, there's already talk of a Plan A+. In other words, the politicians will figure out a way to pretend, now that they've sold the dupes on this notion of austerity, they'll pretend they're imposing austerity, and all the while reverse an austerity policy. One can only hope. But that is across the ocean, where things have become even more dire. In this country, the elite is perfectly willing to allow for the normalization of 9% unemployment, millions upon millions of Americans unemployed and underemployed. And they will allow it to be normal until that pain is felt far and wide and deep enough that the American public says no more. They can shut down and evict protest movements city by city, but they will return in simply a different form. And eventually it will have to, the austerity will have to end. Meanwhile, Barney Frank retires. He is giving a press conference at 1 p.m. to explain his district is looking at more redistricted. It'll be a tougher election for him. He's also turning 72. So we shall see. There is a petition. I want to make sure that I mention this before we go to the Thomas Frank interview. I'm not sure what I'm going to be able to do after the Thomas Frank interview, people. This has been exhausting in and of itself. But more than 100,000 people have signed up for a petition against the censorship that will take place if the Senate passes the so-called Protect IP Act, or SOPA. Sadly, Al Franken is one of the co-sponsors of this legislation. It's a horrible piece of legislation that would effectively shut down things like YouTube or Tumblr, or what else would it affect, Matt? Any type of sharing of
everything and anything. I mean, you could own something and someone could file and take it down.
It would essentially basically be willy-nilly based on what corporations imagine might in some way endanger their business models. It would destroy the internet as we know it. And
like if the government just saw something they didn't like, I mean,
it's just a. I'll have more time in the future to talk about it, but I want to just make you aware of this. www.stopcensorship.org. They are asking Senator Ron Wyden to read their names from the floor of the Senate during his expected filibuster of the Protect IP Act. Wyden has agreed to read censorship opponents' names to buttress his opposition to the legislation, which would give the government new powers to block Americans' access to websites accused of copyright infringement. Just accused of it. This is put out by demandprogress.org. We'll have more follow-up as the week goes on. Now, folks, this is my interview with Thomas Frank. Enjoy it. I may come back to say goodbye and good night, as I will be going right to bed after this, assuming I can make it home. We'll speak to you tomorrow or after this. We'll find out. But in the meantime, enjoy this interview.
Okay, so Thomas, let's first your story here about asking for more government, please, starts off with a fun anecdote, or at least a glimpse at the irony that is John Boehner. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a speech he gave back in September. It was a major speech. It was at the Economic Club of Washington. And, you know, it's up on his website. He's very proud of it. And the speech intrigued me for several different reasons. I mean, there's several very interesting things that he said. And one of them is that he said that the job creators of America are basically on strike, okay, which is a really curious thing for a conservative politician to say. Because usually when they talk about strikes, they're like, you know, call out the National Guard, you know, get the court to start throwing injunctions, you know. It's not something where they want to represent themselves as the voice of the strikers. This was his explanation for why unemployment is so high, you know, why the economy is performing sluggishly. It's because the job creators of America haven't been given every last little item on their wish list, you know, on their legislative wish list. And until the day we do that, then we're going to be stuck with high unemployment.
And this is sort of a strange frame, as you say, because the supposed job creators, the ones that he would have us believe create jobs, are he's suggesting that they operate and that their incentive is how they're being treated by government as opposed to a profit motive.
Exactly. Isn't that curious? And also he's implying that they're very peevish. You know, there's all sorts of – this says about 10 different really strange things about the, you know, business community of this country. It also implies that they are, you know, when he says they're essentially on strike, that they're really well organized, that they're centrally organized, you know. And I should mention that this has come up before and in a very similar context. In 1937, various high officials of the Roosevelt administration said the same thing, but they said it as an accusation. They called it a capital strike, and they gave a series of speeches about what a dreadful thing it was. You know, it wasn't a strike by ordinary Americans, you know, organized in a labor union. It was a strike by monopoly capital, basically. And it went with their argument that, you know, against monopolies, which is, by the way, an argument that you never hear in this country anymore. Now, conservatives at the time and historians ever since then have basically regarded this as either an exaggeration or a sort of a conspiracy theory. And but now, you know, here's John Boehner, leader of the Republican Party, basically telling us, you know, game on. It's really happening.
And he's pointing to a building named after Ronald Reagan to make his point. I'm not sure what
this is an ironic thing. I don't know. He probably sees no irony in it. He gave the speech in the Ronald Reagan building downtown in D.C. And I don't know if you're familiar with the geography of our nation's capital, you know, this beautiful city. But the Ronald Reagan building is this enormous, hulking office building. It's very beautiful, actually. I mean, they really spared no expense in constructing it. And it's when it was being built, a lot of conservatives were very annoyed. It was being built about 10, 15 years ago, they were very annoyed that it had President Reagan's name on it because they thought of it as kind of a boondoggle, you know, which is highly ironic. But then I started to think about this a little more. You know, basically in Boehner's speech, he's claiming that you can't have, you know, unemployment is only a function of the private sector and of business confidence and of, you know, how these people feel about what they're getting from the administration in Washington, what business people feel they're getting from the administration in Washington. That's the only way that you can reduce unemployment. The only way that you can create jobs is to make these people feel really good and do everything they want you to do. And as I was thinking about that building, and it's like, well, that building is a standing, you know, refutation of that. Somebody built that building, and it wasn't the private sector. You know, it was
Thomas. Forgive me. My understanding is that government cannot create jobs, and therefore that it was invisible forces that built that building, or the private market.
It fell from, you know, it fell from the heavens. No one knows where it came from. And you know, and then I started thinking about it a little more, you know, turning my mind back to 1937 and the last time people talked about a capital strike. And in fact, government is able to, you know, to create jobs. They do it all the time. In the Roosevelt administration, they had a program called the Works Progress Administration. They had the Public Works Administration. They had the Civil Works Administration. They employed millions and millions and millions of people, you know, put them to work, created jobs for them, often, you know, very make-work jobs. This was always the criticism, you know, raking leaves or shoveling snow or something like that. But also, you know, they did some really awesome things, you know, like the WPA series of tour guides, which are sort of authoritative to this day. And they created lots and lots and lots of jobs that way. And it would be, you know, we could do that again today if we felt like it.
And the criticism, of course, or part of the criticism from the right, to the extent that it's sincere, let's grant that for the moment. But the criticism, of course, is that if you do pay people to do make work, that these jobs ultimately disappear and they go back out of work. But that's not the case, is it? Because once you create this economic activity, it creates more economic
activity.
Exactly.
Well, you put money in their pocket and they spend it. And the funny thing is that there was once and there probably still is, a consensus in this country about the WPA. We kind of love the WPA. You know, regardless of what we think about big government and how much we hate it, people really like what the WPA did. I went to an elementary school that was built by the WPA. Even Ronald Reagan, the WPA is something that he speaks of very fondly in his memoirs. They sort of saved his family's life during the really bad years of the Depression. They gave his dad and his brother a job, you know, when they couldn't find work in the private sector. Reagan himself proposed a sort of state-level WPA when he was governor of California. But for whatever reason, this is completely off the table, not merely among conservatives, but Democrats, you know, President Obama, when he got his massive stimulus bill passed back in 2009, direct employment by government just wasn't part of it. You know, if you want to create jobs, Then create jobs. You know, hire people. It can be done.
When the WPA, how long was the WPA in effect?
Let me see. I don't have I believe it started in 35 and they wound it down during World War II. You know, the thing is, once the private sector started coming back in 39 and 40, there was no need for it anymore. And so it towards the end of its life, they built, airfields on military bases and stuff like that, and then they sort of disappeared. But it had predecessors that were very interesting. The Civil Works Administration, they set that up in that winter, that terrible winter of 33-34, and employed millions of people and found jobs for them, I mean, in a matter of months. It's when you read what they did back then, it's quite amazing, you know, especially since these days we feel like government can't do anything. You know, they spent all this stimulus money, they gave all these tax breaks, and nothing seems to be working. It's like, well, you know, they did this back then. They did it, you know, very directly. They had a very direct solution. They did it very quickly. They employed millions and millions of people, and it had all sorts of wonderful effects that we still live with today. The buildings, the books, the airfields.
It was very quick, and it was not you didn't need to wait for shovel-ready projects. The idea was you buy somebody a shovel, you put it in their hands, and you pay them to dig.
They did have a lot of shovel-ready projects, and there are plenty of them today. I mean, that term has kind of become discredited because what they say is shovel-ready actually winds up taking like 3 years to get started on or something like that. But in the article that we're talking about in Harper's Magazine, you know, I just sat down with a bunch of my friends and started coming up with things that you could, if you were like a WPA administrator, things that you could come up with people to start working on tomorrow. And it's really not hard to come up with them, you know? Send an army of people into the libraries of the nation to scan the back issue of every newspaper ever published in this country. You know, just to start with that. That would be incredibly useful, in all sorts of ways. Or another one, you know, build out the internet to rural Kansas or the rest of rural America where they, you know, they're so isolated and stuff like that. Or I mean, another reference to our nation's capital here, the really annoying broken down escalators in the metro system. Just come here and fix them all and then go do the same thing in New York City, you know, go to Chicago, go all over the country.
Well, we've got to take a break, but when we come back, let's talk about any proposals that have been offered and about their fate, obviously. That's not quite so suspenseful, but I wonder, and we'll talk about this when we return, if the failure of the super committee, if that deficit hysteria is now behind us, and if there is a chance going forward in the future, particularly in light of what's happening with Occupy Wall Street, if there's a chance to see some real government job creation in the near term. We'll be right back after this. So, Thomas, when we broke, we were talking about the success that the WPA enjoyed, and you had come up just in a casual way with many things that could immediately provide some type of work for the millions and millions of Americans who are out of work if only there was the will to have the government create these jobs directly. We know that over the past couple of years, we've lost over 600,000 government jobs, whether on a county, state, or federal level, and it is dragging the economy down. I wonder now, first off, tell me about some of the proposals that have been floated to do this very thing, despite the fact that we are told by the corporate media that to have government actually create jobs would be akin to full-blown Bolshevik communism.
Yeah. Well, they don't I haven't heard anyone say anything like that. This is actually a very reasonable thing to do, and it's been done in our history. You know, it's not unprecedented. It's just that instead what the reaction is that this option doesn't seem to exist. I mean, nobody talks about it in the media. I haven't heard anybody. It's as though it is contrary to, you know, consensus reality that government can create jobs. We all know in this day and age that only the private sector can create jobs. I mean, people say this all the time, both Democrats and Republicans. Now, that said, there have been a couple of Democrats in the Senate and the House of Representatives that have proposed modern-day versions of the WPA. Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey actually has a proposal. He was I talked to him on the phone, and he was telling me his dad worked for the WPA back in the day. And there's a there was a version in the House that's been introduced twice. I believe it's George Miller is the principal sponsor to set up some kind of government works program. You know, just hire people directly. You know, it is the it seems like when you think about it, it seems like a no-brainer. And economically, I mean, even conservatives, you know, will tell you if you want to, you know, get the most bang for your buck, don't, you know, cut taxes on what's one of the big tax cuts that was in the
You're talking about a payroll moratorium.
Well, the one that really got me was you can depreciate like office equipment. You know, an accelerated depreciation schedule for office equipment. It's like, how on earth is that going to help create jobs? I mean, the answer is it's not. It's going to do nothing. If you want to create jobs, then create jobs. You know, go out there and hire people.
Do you think I understand from the perspective of Republicans as to why you can't even utter these words, because that would reveal just how important government's role is, particularly at a time where we have a very weak demand in our economy and the private sector is driven specifically and almost and exclusively on demand. And when you have that weak demand, they have no incentive to hire, to invest, to go forward in any way, and it's government that needs to step in to create that demand by creating jobs, essentially, so that people have money to spend. What accounts for the Democrats' refusal? I mean, you mentioned a couple of Democrats, but what accounts to them buying so hard into this notion that we can never suggest such a thing?
Well, they aren't the Democrats. I mean, they aren't the Democratic Party of Franklin Roosevelt anymore, or the party of Harry Hopkins, you know, or Harry Truman or anything like that. Those Democrats, you know, they don't exist anymore. They do. There are a handful of them here in Washington in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and they're great guys, and I wish them luck. But by and large, the Democratic Party a long time ago started down a very different path. You know, they believe in market forces. They accept the sort of laissez-faire orthodoxy just as fervently, or not actually fervently is the wrong word, but that they accept the orthodoxy just as completely as do a lot of Republicans. They tend to modify it with a liberal position on social issues, but they have just as they don't dare suggest things like, you know, let's get government back into the picture. They're also politically afraid. I mean, these guys have been, you know, we live in a conservative era. And the conservatives have been, you know, wailing on Democrats for decades with these, you know, the words big government. And you just, you know, you think about what would happen, you know, the first time Fox News manages to film, you know, if we set up some new WPA, the first time they manage to film some new WPA worker, you know, taking a break, leaning on his shovel, you know, when he's supposed to be digging a hole somewhere.
We're paying these people to work, and they're actually eating.
Oh yeah, they would have a field day.
Well, now let me ask you this: in terms of if you see the chance or the likelihood that we may be entering, and maybe it's something that won't happen till after the election, in terms of really genuinely entering a new era, but with the failure of the super committee, which I think was at least to a large extent, obviously had to do with the Republicans' refusal to raise any revenue. But the Democrats seemed very willing, at least, in the event that there was new revenue, to cut some social service programs. But now we have Occupy Wall Street on the scene, and already in a couple of months, it seems to have dramatically changed, at the very least, the framing and the narrative that's going on.
Yeah, it really has. And that is a remarkable shift that you mentioned. I don't know if you know about this, but I recently finished a book. It's going to be out in a couple of weeks about the last 2 years and the sort of amazing conservative comeback after the 2008 elections, when everybody thought they were finished. You know, you'd had this enormous financial crisis, and and all the pundits were saying the Republican Party is dead, it has to moderate itself, all this sort of thing. And they did the opposite, and they succeeded. And there was a time there where they were completely dominating the conversation on every imaginable issue, every imaginable economic issue. And this is what I really like about Occupy Wall Street, is they've completely changed the conversation just in the last month or so. And that's fantastic. I mean, all kinds of things that were not permissible to say, or things that people like you and I would say, but nobody else, are now permissible to say in the mainstream media. Suddenly, it's as though a light has gone on in people's heads. And let's hope it goes as far as to put something like what I'm describing here back on the table. I mean, the thing is, economists all know that this has been done before, and they know that this could work, and that, in fact, it is a very effective way. Well, to create jobs, it's the most effective way. You want to create jobs, hire people. There it is. It works.
The shortest distance between two spots is a straight line.
It's been sort of mentally off the table, and it would be wonderful if it was something that we could talk about again.
Well, I mean, I guess that's the open-ended question, is whether or not, as we see Occupy Wall Street entrenched during the winter and then continue on in the spring of next year, leading up to an election year, it's very hard to imagine anything, any bold move being taken during an election year. But one has to wonder if next year's not going to be about even pushing the conversation even further in the direction that you're talking about. And in the event that we have a sympathetic president at that time, which would either be very bizarre Mitt Romney, or perhaps an evolved...
No, it would be Obama. This is
Obama. Yeah. There's an opportunity there, isn't there?
I think there absolutely is. And I was one of those people that I've been very, very depressed about Obama. I was one of those people that was very idealistic about him in 2008, and then sort of got disillusioned, as he capitulated on issue after issue after issue. And it's nice to finally see some other, power in the country pushing back the other direction. That's a very refreshing thing. And in fact, this hasn't happened. Sam, I've been talking about this stuff, the distribution of wealth and, the concentration of wealth and the fraud on Wall Street and all this stuff for a long, long, long time. And suddenly, I'm not crazy anymore.
Well, Thomas, I got to tell you, Thomas Frank, I never thought you were crazy. It was the rest of the country has just caught up to you. And I appreciate your spending the time talking to us.
Anytime.
All right, folks. All right. That was Thomas Frank. I'm going to have him back on the program. Carry the conversation even a little further. Wow, even on a sick day, you freeloaders, you get almost a full show. And I notice from our stats, not many of you, but a couple of thousand have yet to listen to the Glenn Greenwald, Jesse LaGreca podcast on Thanksgiving Day. And the Chris Hayes, Janine Garofalo podcast from the day before. Go listen to that. Or go back and listen to the Fran Lebowitz show. That was great. We will go into the better half of the show, but I only got about 5 minutes in me, folks. I just can't help myself, though. Want to give members that little bit extra of content. We're about to have a merch store. It's going to be launching shortly. It's up now. We don't have a link to it yet, but we will. But tomorrow we'll have that merch. So if you want to buy some Majority Report merch for the holidays, it's there. But of course, the best way, if you want to support this program, is to become a member at majority.fm. If you're buying other junk, use our link at Amazon by going to the front page of majority.fm. The link is on the right-hand side of the page, right-hand column. As you're looking at the page, click it, bookmark it, use that as your Amazon thing. We get some kickback from that. And, of course, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade makes a great holiday gift, or a gift for any time, ladies and gentlemen. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get a 10% discount. We'll be here tomorrow. I will be healthier, I have no doubt. Somewhat healthier. See you then.